Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Robert Salas, who is the author of Unidentified, the UFO Phenomena, How World Governments Have Conspired to Conceal Humanity's Biggest Secret. Robert Salas is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, and he served 7 years on active duty, including some top secret assignments, commanding our international ballistic missiles as a launch officer. So he was very much in the heart of the Cold War and knows a lot about the government's ability and how it keeps secrets and why it keeps secrets. And this book is very interesting because of his background as a military officer. And we have interviewed Stan Friedman on multiple occasions on this radio show, as well as other prominent authors in the area of UFO phenomena. And we're glad to welcome Robert Salas back on the show today. Thanks, Robert, for joining us.
Happy to be with you, Susan. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Robert, would you give our listeners a little bit of your background and how you became interested in UFO phenomena through what happened in your experience as a launch officer?
Sure. I was in the Air Force from, 1964 to 1971. I resigned at that time. In 1967, I was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base. I was part of a two-man crew that would go down to an underground capsule where we had control of Minuteman I missiles, 10 of them. On this particular night, October 24th, 1967, I was the one, on alert status and get a call from my topside guard. We had six guards upstairs monitoring the facility and also going out on call to the launch facilities, which were about a mile or two away. And I get this one call. The guard says they've been seeing strange lights in the sky, making odd maneuvers, very fast, making 90-degree turns, no noise, that sort of thing. And I even said, like UFOs, because we had had reports in the local newspaper about people seeing lights in the sky, et cetera. I wasn't really that interested in that subject at the time. And so I just kind of dismissed the call, and then 5 minutes later, he calls back. This time, he's screaming into the phone. He's obviously frightened. He's got all the guards out there with their weapons, and saying that he's looking at the front gate area, and above the front gate, there's a lighted object. It's a red, glowing, pulsating light, about 40, 50 feet in diameter. And it's just sitting there, hovering. He wanted me to tell him what to do next. I didn't know what to say at first. And then finally said, make sure nothing comes in the gated area, the fenced area. And so he hung up, went to tell my command about the phone calls. And then that's when the missiles started shutting down while this object was still up there. So we lost all 10 of them. By lost, I mean we had a way of querying the system. It was guidance and control system failure. So the guidance system had been somehow upset. When we reported it back to Malmstrom Air Force Base, we were about 100 miles away. They said the same thing had happened at another site. At that time, I thought it was that evening, but it turns out it had happened about a week earlier. So within the span of 8 days, we lost 20 ICBMs to these objects. That's it in a nutshell. We were told never to talk about this. Actually, we were ordered to sign a statement never to talk about this. I can go on and tell you why I was able to come forward, or I thought I was.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I got out of the Air Force in 71. Of course, I was still obligated under this non-disclosure statement not to talk about it. But in 1994, I picked up a book called Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. On page 301 of that book, there's a short paragraph talking about missiles being shut down during a UFO sighting in Malmstrom Air Force Base 67. And so I decided to go ahead and take a chance and submit a FOIA request to the Air Force, and Freedom of Information Act request. And they wrote back and said, you know, this is classified, but since it's been so long, we're going to go ahead and declassify what turned out to be the Echo flight incident, which I thought was my incident at the time. But it turns out that the incident that they declassified was the one that happened about a week earlier than mine. So I started talking about this publicly because I thought it was clear to do that. But I didn't find out till later that my incident was an Oscar flight, and but by then I'd already gone public, and so I decided to go ahead and continue that. And I've been talking about this for some 20 years now.
Well, it's interesting that probably yours was not the only incident where some sort of electronic interference occurred to change, you know, what we were able to do with the weapon systems. I've heard rumors since then that there have been reports of people coming forth saying that, at least in the U.S., that nuclear testing has been interfered with as well. Have you heard of those reports?
Yes. In New Mexico, they've had similar sightings where these objects were flying around during the test of their, I think, ground air missiles there. And also, Robert Hastings wrote a book called UFOs and Nukes, and I think he details other reports during nuclear testing where nuclear weapons were tested out in the Pacific and UFOs were sighted there. I'm not familiar with that one. However, there is one, 1964, where a missile was launched out of Vandenberg. And, film was actually made, had special equipment to film the reentry vehicle or warheads. This was on an Atlas missile, and when they brought back the film, they could see an object flying circles around the warhead, actually shooting beams of light at that. There have been many, many cases. I list about 14 other cases in my book, but there are even more than that, similar to what happened to me.
Well, this is a question I've had, and I haven't really researched it, but I thought maybe you might have known. In the last, say, 10 years, have there been any nuclear warhead testing that has gone forward without some sort of interference or at least sightings of potential interference in the area? Do you know of any that have been successful? I mean, what I'm thinking is that maybe most of the testing that the different countries are trying to do is being monitored very carefully, and there would be some sort of evidence that there's at least extraterrestrial observation of the testing.
Yeah, I'm really not familiar with cases involving nuclear testing per se. Now, there have been, I point out, in 1945, aircraft were scrambled against UFOs that were seen over Hanford nuclear site, which is what's producing plutonium for the first atomic bomb. And there have been many instances of UFO sightings over nuclear energy facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, after the accident at Chernobyl, there was actually a written report in Pravda, the Russian newspaper, stating that many people saw UFOs over that facility
right.
before and after it exploded, meltdown. So, and then we've had many sightings during our wars. You know, I point that out in my book too, Vietnam. Quite a few sightings in Vietnam. Iraq, I just made contact with, not just, but a few years back, a witness who was a platoon sergeant, and his entire platoon saw this huge triangular-shaped object just south of Baghdad Airport when they were on patrol. So
mm-hmm.
I know they've been monitoring our wars, certainly have been monitoring all of our wars since 1945. Even before, 1942, we had the Battle of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
incident, which you're probably familiar with. Yeah, as far as testing itself goes, that material is still classified.
Yeah, it is, exactly. Well, you know, we hear on the news intermittently that North Korea has tried to test something but failed. It's just interesting that, at least in what I'm saying, I'm not researching it, so I don't know for sure, but I have just not heard of a successful nuclear test by anybody, you know, even our supposed enemies, that that went off without some sort of a glitch. And it's just interesting that we know that there is extraterrestrial observation of these testing areas, as well as, like you said, there's been a number of reports of conventional weapons not working. The last one I know of is there was a battleship near, I believe it was China, and the battleship radar defenses went down, and the Chinese fighters were able to, I think, do multiple simulated attacks against the plane, against the ship, without the ship being able to do anything about it. And that was reported in the alternative media. Did you hear anything about that? That was fairly recent, a few months ago. It might have been
ago. I hadn't heard anything about that.
Yeah. But it's interesting that we're being played with. I mean, it's obvious that complicated systems like your radar system around a ship just taken down, and then you're shown that you're totally vulnerable, just in a simulation. But still, it must be of some concern to the military officers that are running these operations. They really don't have what they think they have, you know.
Absolutely, it's of concern. In my case, in particular, we retrieved a telegram from mm-hmm. SAC headquarters, Strategic Air Command headquarters, regarding this Echo flight shutdown, which I just talked about. And then in that telegram, it used the words, "This is of grave concern to this command."
Exactly.
Obviously, if something unknown can control or shut down mm-hmm. nuclear weapons, then it's got to be of grave concern.
That's right. Well, obviously, anything that involves electronics can be manipulated by extraterrestrials. I mean, that would seem to be the evidence that it is energetic,
yeah.
electronic, and you would assume, since they have a technology much advanced, even beyond what we know scientifically, that they would be able to do many things that you know we're not capable of doing. Do you have any opinions as of what the messages are here? To, you know, we need to talk a little bit about the cabal and how that developed, I guess, first. But You know, the cabal is being definitely sent messages here by these, you know, whatever extraterrestrials are involved in these incidents. And it may not be the same extraterrestrials that the cabal is actively working with. You know, it may be a different group.
Maybe. The message that I've gotten from my own experience and from many of the other experiences having to do with nuclear weapons or nuclear power is really, number one, get rid of your nuclear weapons. You know, nuclear weapons are not weapons of war, because no sane country would use these in warfare, because obviously it would cause so much total destruction. They're weapons of mass destruction, plain and simple. So they're not weapons of war, really. They're not going to really protect us. You know, this fallacy about nuclear deterrence, holding a lot of nuclear weapons as a deterrent mm-hmm. against others, has not worked, because other countries seem, more and more countries seem to want these things. I think that's one of the main messages: get rid of your nuclear weapons. The other message, of course, is learn how to control nuclear energy. I think they probably do use some form of nuclear energy. There has been indications on many of these cases of evidence of radiation at the landing sites or nearby. Obviously with the incident at Fukushima and Chernobyl and others, Three Mile Island, we have not yet been able to use nuclear energy in a safe way. So these are things we really have to work at.
Now, in your book, you indicate that the cabal, the part of the government that keeps secrets, probably started around the time of Roswell, you know, because of necessity. And you want to outline what you understand about, the cover-up at Roswell, and then how the thing that's really interesting about your book is that because you understand the mechanisms by which disinformation and secrecy and intimidation and all of the different tools used by the part of the government that does not want this out, you can really lay it out, and so people can understand why now, when the average person is told that somebody sees a UFO, they're automatically in their mind thinking that they're not mentally stable. You know, that's kind of been programmed into us. And how that occurred.
No, the cabal uses all that. You know, we have been inundated with these alien invasion movies. I think elements of the cabal have instigated those kinds of things, those kinds of thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Independence Day, that was a good one.
Right. And Alien, the movie Alien is enough to...
scare the Jesus out of you.
So I think there's a definite program of disinformation going on. The cabal also monitors witnesses, tracks witnesses. They at times try to intimidate witnesses, but I think their biggest weapon is ridicule. Because they keep claiming, you know, there's no evidence that any of this has happened, et cetera. But there really is plenty of evidence, and it's a question of whether or not you want to accept it as such, whether or not it's convincing to you that this has happened. By evidence, of course, I'm talking about witnesses, very credible witnesses, astronauts, governors.
Pilots.
Pilots.
The majority of the Air Force pilots that I knew had all seen the UFOs, I'll tell you.
Right. So, so it's really the cabal against us, us meaning those of us that have had experiences and are trying to get the public to realize that this is a real phenomenon. And that's why I've been at this for some 20 years. that's my main motivation. It's not, you know, being famous or making a lot of money or anything like that. I'm just trying to get the word out. Since mm-hmm. I did have the experience, I feel responsible for doing that.
Well, I was the chief of plastic surgery at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 4 years between 1984 and 1988, and I had more than a couple, I think four or five high-ranking officers tell me that they'd seen live aliens. Isn't that interesting?
Really?
Yeah.
It is.
So at the time, I didn't have a lot of interest in the subject, and it wasn't until recently when I think the show was called The UFO Files. I was watching that, and then I realized that Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was since Roswell, was where they brought the ships and the bodies, live or not alive, for analysis. And then I interviewed the author of The Real Area 51, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who was it's a very well-researched book and one that, I had no idea that Wright-Pat was there was that much information, and much of the information came from deathbed confessions and, you know, things that you would expect that people ended up wanting to tell their story before they died. And so it was just very interesting to know I was in the midst of it there, had some evidence of it, but really didn't realize we were probably sitting on top of most of the hard evidence that existed for, in terms of bodies and crafts.
Yes. I think Philip Corso talks about the fact that, some of the bodies were delivered to Wright-Pat, and also that Wright-Pat contracted with, civilian engineering school there, Carnegie Mellon University helped analyze some of the equipment that they brought back from the Roswell.
Yeah, there was metals that were totally, the description of the metal in Roswell, you could crumple it up and yet it would go back to its original form. It looked like aluminum foil, but with very different properties.
Right.
And it was not anything that we had on Earth. I mean, it was when they analyzed it.
Yeah. And, of course, I was stationed at Wright-Pat for a short time to finish up my master's degree. And I talk about an incident that I had when I was there. Very briefly, I met one of my old ex-classmates from the Air Force Academy there. I hadn't seen for a while, and he said they had a job for me. I said, well, I was just there to get my degree and finish up and then get my next assignment. And he said, well, we'll talk later. And then a little after that, I get a call from the base psychiatrist's office. And they said they want to see me. And, of course, I hadn't complained about anything. But it was like an order. I had to show up at the base psychiatrist's office. And so I go there and ask the orderly, what's this all about? And he says, well, the psychiatrist will explain it to you. Come on back and we'll talk to him. And I said, no, I don't think so. Actually, I defied the situation and said, I'm not going to go back and talk to him unless he comes out here and tells me what this is all about.
Right.
I had not, you know, asked to see him. I had not filed any kind of complaint or anything.
Right.
So he comes back a little later and says, well, you can go now, sir.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that. But
probably being recruited for their team there.
Could be, yeah. That's a possibility. The other thing is that they might have got me to talk about my UFO incident and then put that on my record as this guy's unreliable or whatever. anyway.
Well, one of the more disturbing things about this whole business is, as you realize, are the abductions.
Right.
You know, the abductions are. I mean, all of the other stuff is kind of at arm's length, but when you realize that up to 1 million people that may have been abducted, and there's certainly a huge amount of similarity in their stories, and they're not mental patients at all, this becomes very, very disturbing. Do you know if the abductions are still occurring?
Certainly, I'm sure they are. There are many groups throughout the country that that help people who have had these experiences, and so I've been in contact with one of the local groups here called CERO, C-E-R-O. That's run by Yvonne Smith, who's a hypnotherapist or a therapist that has quite a few members. So, you know, I'm not an expert in the field, but I have had an experience, as I pointed out in my book.
Right.
I can go through that.
Yes, that'd be great.
My wife can also chime in here because she was had her own separate experience, but also helped me with mine.
Okay.
So in 1985, I was living in a beach community. Here in California, I hadn't talked about my UFO incident at that time. We were living in a house which we both remember, and with two small children. And I wake up one evening, and I see this blue light coming from the living room. And it seemed like it was a floating mist of some sort, but it was this bluish light. I wake up my wife and I tell her about the blue light. I'm going to get up and investigate. And as I start to get off the bed, I'm paralyzed. I can't move. And I struggle really hard to try to get
And
up.
By the way, that's very common. That paralysis part is in many of the stories.
Yeah, right. It is common. And because they want to immobilize you, obviously, so you won't
run away.
grab your gun and shoot them or run
exactly.
away or something. Anyway, next thing I remember is seeing this figure in the doorway. It seemed to have a hood on. And I'm aware that there's others in the room at this time. You know, I'm still trying to recover memories, so I can't put a face to these others, except that they were small. So then I start floating off the bed, floating towards the window, and thinking they don't know how to open the window, because I had latched
it
before. I don't know why I thought that, other than that these were small creatures, and they might have been like children, I don't know. But the point is, I went right through the window. I know how crazy this sounds, but I'm telling you, that's what came out of these therapy sessions I've had. I went right through the window. Next, I'm on a table having something put in front of my eyes. It's a long needle, seems like a long needle. They place it right in front of my eyes and say they're going to insert this into my groin area. No communication verbally, but I get this message. And they say it's not going to hurt, but it certainly was very painful.
they don't have a good concept of pain. This is also...
I don't think so.
This is also in story after story. They don't think they're hurting you, but they do.
And so this is the second reason I'm convinced this was not a dream, because I still remember the intensity of that thing.
That's right.
And as soon as I mention or think this, the pain goes away.
Right.
After that, it was basically taken back to my bedroom, and we don't remember anything the next day, and neither one of us. I forgot to mention my wife went unconscious after I told her about the light. The only reason I So I didn't remember any of this until about 2007, after I started getting some bits and pieces of this in my mind. And one day I asked my wife if she had seen a blue light entering our bedroom one night in 1985, mm-hmm. and she said yes. She remembered mm-hmm. that, and that convinced me to go see some hypnotherapists. I've had four sessions now, and that's how I came up with these details.
Well, it seems like in a lot of the other cases too that with time, the bits and pieces do come back. So whatever they give you for the amnestic effect, it wears off, or seems to.
Yeah,
that's common.
That is, and I think more and more of these experiencers are retrieving more and more of their memories. You know, because obviously this is a shock and a very extraordinary experience, and it takes time to come to terms with it. Well, my wife's here. If you'd like to speak to her
sure.
about her experience. Okay, I'll put her on here.
All Hold right.
On. Hello.
Dr. Hello, Susan. How are you?
I'm good. Hope your day is beautiful and all is going well. Thank you
well, great. Well, we're enjoying the interview with your husband. He's a wealth of information, a different viewpoint than what we usually get from and different knowledge base. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about what you remember of that night with the blue light?
Sure. Yeah. This, again, was around 1985. That's the best time frame that both of us can, point in on, focus in on.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory of it is our bedrooms were to the back of a one-floor plan house, and there was a long hallway leading from the living room back to the bedroom area. And for some reason, I don't know why, we had gone to bed, and I had opened my eyes. I don't know if I heard a noise. I have no idea what, made me, open my eyes. But I saw this misty, bluish-gray light in the hallway. And at that time, we didn't keep any lights on in the house. We really still don't, except for the computer lights that shine and the different appliances, I guess. But basically, the light was a very eerie, misty-looking color. And now, I don't remember my husband trying to talk to me or wake me up, what he described.
Mm-hmm.
We're beginning to think that maybe there were two different incidences, but my memory of that is that I felt like I wanted to be an ostrich and stick my head in the ground. I was sort of scared. I knew that that was not a light natural to the house, and
mm-hmm.
so I thought, I'm just going to close my eyes and go to sleep.
Yeah.
That was how I...
maybe it'll go away.
maybe it'll go away. That's how I handled the situation at
mm-hmm.
that time. So,
and he got up. He got up to get a weapon. That's a typical male response.
Yeah, at least he wanted to. But again,
he couldn't.
And actually, we don't keep guns in the house. So I don't know. He might have had to run to the kitchen to get a knife or something.
Right.
But anyway, that was the first experience. And since then, I have had two other what I would call major experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And we live over in Ojai now in California, and this was probably about 10 years ago. Well, back
mm-hmm.
up just a little bit. Well, my husband took a job. He worked for the FAA,
mm-hmm.
and he accepted a job in Indonesia in the early 90s, and so we went over there for him, it was a two-year assignment. I was there for about a year and a half. But he and my son went early because he had to start school at the international school over there. So they went early. And while they were gone, I started to have some spiritual experiences, I guess is the best way you could say that. And so with that, when I arrived in Indonesia, I knew that I wanted to pursue meditation and yoga. And so it took me about a year, but I found a yoga teacher over there who taught meditation. And it was through him that the information came through his guidance that I was a healer. And I thought, well, that felt right, but I didn't know what to do about it. I had nobody to teach me anything. So I just simply followed his advice and started to activate my hands. And voila, you know, wonderful things started to happen when I put my hands on people.
Right.
I don't know for sure if that is something that is was tied in with that incident in 1985, but that was probably about a good maybe 6 or 7 years later. Well, about 1993, actually. Yeah, I remember that now. 93 is when I was told that I was a healer. And so after that, we, you know, moved to California again. And I was experiencing just wonderful, you know, wonderful energy coming through me that was pretty dynamic. And I was awed, and I still am awed with energy healing. And I have a practice to this day. We have a healing room.
That's
here
great.
At home.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, so before, when we moved into this house, which was the year 2000, Bob was, you know, he's a teacher, and so he had gone off that morning to his job, and so I was sort of in a half-awake, half-asleep state, and all of a sudden, I heard tones, I guess is the best way to describe it, and I thought it was somebody's cell phone. Well, we lived in a single-family home, so I thought, you know, is somebody outside the window here? It just was so odd. So I sort of discounted that again, thinking that was weird. And about a minute or two later, I hear the same sequence of tones, and it went like this. Da-da-da-da, da-da. And I'll never forget that. In addition to hearing those tones, I also felt the vibration in the back of my head of those tones as they played in my head. So it was at the base of the skull as it attaches to the spine.
Right.
I heard it one more time, felt the vibration one more time, and then nothing since, not anything since then. So that was always a bizarre situation to me and hard to explain. Recently...
Well, that sounds like an activation.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
But probably not by the same things as the blue light, because the ETs involved with the activations are way higher energy and much more much more respectful of one's boundaries. So,
oh, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for sharing that. The next major incident happened just this year, as a matter of fact, last spring. And I had always been curious about what had happened to me, especially, you know, this thing with the back of my head. And when we were at the Ciro group run by Yvonne Smith, there's a gentleman there who had equipment who would come to your home and do readings with mineral black lights to see evidence of ET presence because they leave a residue, you know, sort of a fluorescence. And then also Gauss meter and, you know, like a metal detector if you had any implants in your body. So we had him come out to the house, and of course, you know, there was indications of that pretty much throughout the house, but especially in the bedroom areas.
Right.
So, and when he scanned our bodies, especially the you know, we didn't remove our clothing, but he did our hands and around our face. There was, with this black mineral light, there was a residue of a bright neon blue half circle on my index finger on my left hand. That was a shock to me. I couldn't see that without knowing or get that mineral light showing that. And then Bob, he did Bob's hand, and there was a fluorescent red patch between his small finger and the next finger over. Mm-hmm. And so the question was, how long has that been there? You know, that was a mm-hmm. shock. And I was thinking he was going to say, well, that's probably been, you know, a few weeks or months or whatever. And he said, that's just a matter of days that happened. And
oh my goodness.
Like, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And mm-hmm. and with that information, it enters into your mind, how often is this going on that, you know, I have no memory of it. And he said something to the effect of that he considered us, quote unquote, frequent flyers.
Right.
I'll never get over that. Frequent flyers. So anyway,
right.
There were no metallic indications in our bodies, but later on we did have some x-rays done through a chiropractor's office. And mm-hmm. there were no metallics that were found, but we did find through this gentleman telling us that about 30% of the implants are metallic and 70% are fibrous.
Right,
so
yes, yeah, so they won't show up.
They won't show up, mm-hmm. clearly, yeah. So I was hoping that I would have some sort of hard proof about that, but that mm-hmm. didn't happen.
Right,
so
right.
About a week, that was on a Friday night, and the following Tuesday, I have a dream. And in the dream, a tall white comes to me. Very, very benevolent, no hair, tall and slim. And mm-hmm. again, this is in the dream, and takes me by the hand and takes me out through the wall.
Uh-huh.
And in the process of doing that, in the dream, there was this incredible explosion of light, and it was like molecules were being moved out in every direction. It was mm-hmm. just an explosion of light and molecules. I did remember that dream. I had trouble remembering a lot of my dreams, but that one was real clear when mm-hmm. I woke up that morning, and I shared it with Bob. And my sense was I either was taken through that wall or taken through a dimension. Wasn't quite sure exactly how it happened.
I think I think they're showing you an interdimensional shift with that, which is coming up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
following... Uh-huh, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a little bit more to the story.
All right.
Following that, about 2 days after that, I had marks on my arm. I had indentations where it looked mm-hmm. like puncture wounds, two on the right wrist and two on the upper left arm with a band of red that looked like I had been restrained or something to make my skin turn that reddish color. I'm very fair. Mm-hmm. And so, and then a patch of white and then some more red in that upper shoulder area on the left. About 2 days after that dream, I was touching the top of my head, just moving my hair around, and I realized mm-hmm. that really hurt. It was really sensitive up there, and it felt like there was a bump. And mm-hmm. so I didn't say anything to Bob about, you know, what I felt, but I said, would you touch the top of my head and tell me what you think? And he touched it and felt around on the top, and he said, oh, there's a bump up there. And I mm-hmm. said, yeah, and I have no recollection of bumping into anything, or I couldn't mm-hmm. explain that in any other way but attaching it to the experience.
Right.
From what the dream, of course, I've learned now that they reality is made into a dream state many times with what happens when contact
true.
Is made.
That's
so about 2 weeks after that, I'm outside at the back of the house near that bedroom area, and we have like a path that is it's not cement, it's just wood chips and things like that, so weeds are always popping up back there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm back there pulling some of the weeds, and all of a sudden I noticed this object. And the object looked like a small metal ball.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up. Ordinarily, I would have just thrown it away, but it was unusual looking. It was very heavy, and I had remembered Bob talking about the fact that molten metal had been observed in a couple of cases of people seeing UFOs and seeing this molten metal mm-hmm. drop off their ship. Right. So I took it in to him and showed it to him, and I said, you know, what do you think? And he said, basically, that's really interesting. And we decided to save it, and it looked like it had been an object that had been highly heated and then folded over. There was an enfoldment to it, but mm-hmm. it was still sort of roundish, and it looked like really just basically a rusted metal piece of metal there. So we put it away, and then about an hour later, he comes in the house, and he says, guess what I found? I said, what? And he shows me yet another piece, and I said, mm-hmm. oh, my goodness, show me where you found that. So mm-hmm. we went to the back of the house, and where he showed me was probably about 2.5 feet away from the one that I found.
Mm-hmm.
So we had two of these objects, and since then, Bob has taken a piece like a Dremel saw and sawed off a piece, which was very, very hard. The metal was extremely hard. It took him between 10 and 15 minutes to saw mm-hmm. just like a fingernail piece of it off of the object. And it's highly magnetic, we found out, and it is highly polished. The inside of it did not look at all the way the outside did as rusted mm-hmm. metal. The inside looked very shiny, highly polished, almost like a combination of stainless steel and, you know, some other shiny objects. So it was really weird. But at this point, we are trying to have that analyzed. To see, you know, what sort of isotopes are in there, if they're, you know, something from this yeah. planet or elsewhere.
Well, that'll be fascinating to see what that is and if it matches other objects that have been found at sites, because, you know, there's many, many, many evidence of abduction experiences now coming forth, especially mm-hmm. since hypnosis is so effective in recall.
Right, right.
But you might wonder why a show called Temple of Health is talking about the extraterrestrial UFO phenomena. And I'll tell mm-hmm. you a brief story that I think you'll be able to appreciate. I was one of the lecturers at the Truth Convention here in Atlanta, and that's where I met Stan Friedman and David Wilcox and Stephen Greer mm-hmm. and, you know, the whole group of them. And yeah. I had actually had Stephen on the program. He's an ER doctor, so we're buddies. But basically, after I presented on something totally different. I presented on the FDA and their, you know, their shenanigans. But so basically, I was in meditation and I had three beings appear in front of me. In meditation, one was an Arcturian, one a Assyrian, and one a Palladian, and they mm-hmm. requested that I use my radio show to educate people about the subject.
Oh,
and it was a direct request from three different groups that I do that. So I've interviewed Stan and three or four times, and the woman who wrote the book on Betty and Barney Hill, mm-hmm. their niece.
Exactly.
You know, I actually ran into her in the bathroom at the Truth Convention, so I actually met her.
Mm-hmm. She's a sweet lady.
But, you know,
I've met her too.
Right. So, you know, all of these people, your husband included, are highly respected and logical and sound scientific backgrounds and you know, very... very good researchers when they write books. So mm-hmm. that's my job, is to help, you know, promote the understanding of this through, since I'm not standard mainstream media, we're being recruited to do that. And
right.
and I think
right.
it's in counter to the disinformation campaign by the cabal. So
yeah,
that's why the health show is doing this. So, but I'm really pleased to hear that you're involved in energy healing. I think that that's wonderful. And we do a lot of that here at Plastikos. I do energy medicine on everybody in recovery before they leave here after surgery. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm just
highly
so happy
effective.
To hear that. It has
yeah.
been a long journey for the energy healers of this country.
It has.
To,
it has.
have it realized that this is an essential part of a healing process.
Right. It's certainly wonderful that you're doing that. And thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I enjoyed speaking with you also. Thank you. I'll turn you back over to Bob.
Okay.
Okay.
All righty. Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Sure. People can go to my website, spiralgalaxy.org, and on there I've got an evidence page. They can go there and listen to audio tape of some of the witnesses supporting my case, and also written testimony in the form of affidavits and other documents that I received under FOIA. And they can go to, they can also buy my book there if they want a signed copy. I'd be happy to do that. Or they can go to Amazon.com and buy either one of my books.
Right. And your first book is Fated Giant. That's the detail of the UFO incident.
Right. Yeah. That talks about the incident itself. And then the second book I've written, Unidentified UFO Phenomenon, is more of a broad spectrum of my experience with the phenomenon over 20 years.
Yeah, and I want to tell people that in the book, because Robert has such a extensive knowledge of really the mechanism and how things work in terms of military secrets and how that is structured, I think it gives a great explanation of how the other side, so to speak, has kept this secret for so many years and is continuing still to play the same end game, which is that anybody who comes forth is ridiculed or some sort of disinformation is given about them. And even Stephen Greer, I interviewed Stephen here for a couple of years ago, and Stephen had been the victim of frequency weapon attacks. I mean, they went so far as to try to take him out, and he actually developed melanoma, but he got over it because he's pretty smart and knows how to do that. And so, they go far beyond ridicule. They actually try to assassinate some of the people, and that is, I mean, I think, I'm sorry, but I'm gonna make that known on my radio show that is that's like an extreme response, but certainly he had enough spiritual protection not to succumb to it, which was good.
Right. Well, the recent revelations about the CIA, for example, using extraordinary measures of torture, things like that, just shows the extent to which our own intel agencies will go to. But this is an even more elite, if you will, group or select group within the intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of this UFO cabal, I think.
Yeah.
But you're right. I don't think they'll stop at anything to maintain these secrets.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your information with our audience. We've been talking to Robert Salas, who's the author of Unidentified, the UFO Phenomena, and I recommend you read his book to understand more thoroughly, because it helped me understand more thoroughly about how this whole campaign is structured and, more importantly, what the disclosure community needs to do to get around the blockages.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Reverend Dr. Kate Tate, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape Our World. And then on the 27th, Sonia Grace, Become an Earth Angel, Advice and Wisdom for Finding Your Wings and Living in Service. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.